Hey, Nora.
Hey, Sandy.
How goes? How you doing?
I'm in such a crunch right now that I feel like I'm drowning. That's how I'm doing.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. No. I'm sorry. Is that...
It's okay. It's not your fault.
I know, but I am sorrowful for you, you know? That kind of sorry. Is it book stuff?
Yeah.
Is it investigative journalism stuff?
It's
Is it
book
representing
stuff.
The people stuff?
It's representing the people stuff too. Yeah, it's just like everything feels like it's all like on fire right now. And yeah, if I'm not responding to your messages, folks, that's why. Because I'm just like, oh my God, there's just so much. And I want to just mention something that's so weird. So I have an article that's coming out today about how many people have come to Canada from Gaza. So I'm still on this. And you'll remember from the live show in Edmonton, I don't know if we said this on stage, but, you know, zero families had come as of mid-April, right?
That's right, yeah.
So for the second time in a row, I've been scooped already by, I think the first one was the Canadian Press, this time's the Globe and Mail. From this data that I'm like, IRCC was holding it from me. And I was emailing them every other day being like, why aren't you responding? What's the number? What's the number? Why aren't you responding? Because I held the story hearing from families that there were people that had come to Gaza, but the Canadian government had said zero. So I was trying to figure out what was going on there. And so as the story's finished, it's written for Thursday. It's done. And then Saturday, I got scooped again. And I'm like, what is going on? This is so weird. I mean, it's weird, of course, that the articles keep getting held, but that's just the reality with small independent news organizations. But it's like, IRCC, what the fuck, man? So I'm also kind of pissed, but whatever.
Yeah, it sounds like they have their preferred people to break a story. So if they know it's coming out, they will contact who they want. Yep. That's shitty, but it still means that like your work is getting this information out, which is really important, even though they're engaging in some strange tactics. So thanks for doing that work, Nora.
Thanks, of course. It's so important. But anyway, how are you?
I'm good. I'll say I know what it feels like to feel super swamped all the time. And that's really shitty. I'm not feeling that right now. I've submitted my book last week,
and
I'm feeling really good about that. It is now, you know, this is the first time I'm doing this solo, and it's now going through a process called legal review, and I really hope I don't have to do that much for that.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I'm feeling really good about that, and it's one of those things, you know, when you do something like that, I had a week of just my body like fully crashing. It's just like I got sick. I was feeling weak. It was just like a full crash. And now today I'm feeling good again. But one of those things that makes me think about is a conversation I saw happening somewhere online that reminded me of our episode on how important leisure time is. It was a conversation about how like the movie industry is dying and nobody's going back into theaters and streaming has destroyed the theater and so on, blah, 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 blah. And it's like it was somebody else's take that was just like, yeah, OK, maybe. But also, have we taken a look at what has happened to work since the pandemic? Like we were already getting into a really intense gig economy. And since then, that's only worsened, and people's ability to work at all hours of the day through Zoom and using all of these tools that really accelerated in use during the pandemic, it means that people have way, way, way less time to do anything that has anything to do with leisure on a regular schedule. So yeah, maybe it's the streaming industry that has destroyed going out and enjoying a night at the movies or a bunch of other types of leisure activities that people could enjoy. Or maybe it's also that all of these things that we've come to expect in our lives, like time for leisure, are being chipped away at slowly. And that's just harming us in ways that we haven't thought about before. So time for leisure, Nora, I hope you can make some time for leisure. And if you haven't listened to that episode of our podcast, it was a very popular one. And I mm-hmm. encourage you to do that.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to get any leisure until mid-June, but I'm looking forward to that crash.
Too long. That's so way long. Too long.
I know, but I just, there's no way. This book is due June 1st. So that is where I am. But you know what, Sandy? I'm still grateful.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Who are you grateful to? Are there any specific people?
Yeah, this week I'm grateful especially to everyone that shared the podcast, sent us feedback, even if I couldn't respond, and thankful especially to folks that shot some money our way. I have to say, if you listened to the Daily News yesterday morning, maybe I sounded more like rested or, I don't know, on the ball. The episode came out at 4:30 in the morning. It's because I was able to do it the night before, thanks to some script writing help for the Daily News. And so your donations really, really, really do help. And it does lighten the load. So thank you so much this week to Janetta, Kate, Ryan, and Margaret Ann for your financial contributions to this little project.
Thank you so, so much. Ah, so great. I love it. Nora, before we get into our main story for tonight, which is going to be about the campus protests, I know that you did because I heard this on the Daily News. I know that you heard about it. But this police chase that happened in Ontario, that where the police were chasing someone who stole, maybe, I can't remember exactly if it was that they were successfully stole or tried to steal some items from the LCBO, and they ended up chasing this car on the wrong side of the highway and killing bystanders, people who were using the highway in the way that it was meant to be used, including a baby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is really, really, really wild. And in my mind, it's the exact example of how out of control police are. So you have this situation where an off-duty officer, not minding his own business at the LCBO, calls in what you said looked like an attempted robbery or a robbery, or who knows, because the guy who did it is dead and will never actually get justice, whether or not there was actually something being stolen or if it was just this off-duty cop thinking something was being stolen. Who cares? You should not die over something like that. And what ensues is a reckless and high-speed chase. And it goes through the streets of Bowmanville. I believe it was Bowmanville. It's in Durham region in the east end of the greater Toronto area. And the police are seen on people's like door cams. I can't believe people have door cams, I should just say, but fine, we've got door cams. And you can see that they're driving in residential communities like at just the highest speed, like 100 kilometers an hour through like residential streets. Eventually, you know, the suspect, I guess, like, you know, I imagine is panicking, to like say the least, and enters the 401 the wrong way. And the police follow him. Now, as you said, people died. I've already referenced the individual who they were chasing. He died. But so too did an infant and a pair of grandparents who were visiting from India. The parents, who were also in the car at the time, have said that they're devastated. Obviously, their lives are ruined. They'll never be the same. And all because the police, what, just had to get their guy? They think that they're on TV. They think that they can act like that. Well, they can act like that because there's going to be no repercussions for these guys of any real significance. We know that they were told to even call off the chase, and they didn't call off the chase. And here we are. The aftermath is 4 people dead, including a baby, including a set of grandparents, and including the guy who may or may not have been robbing the store at the time.
It's absolutely unbelievable. It's like in your supposed mandate, police, is to keep people safe. And in doing that, you've decided to chase this person who doesn't pose a danger to anyone. They stole something, potentially, maybe, who knows, stole something. And is on their way. Okay. Even if, you know, you were super committed to the idea of punishment and were like, okay, this guy deserves to be punished. I mean, isn't that why they have license plates and stuff like that? Like, why do you need to, is it worth it to kill four people in order to, what, make sure that this person is brought to justice? Is it worth it to harm as many people who have been harmed? Because, of course, we always talk about these incidents in the numbers of people who have been killed, but it was a 6-car collision. There are people who have been injured by this. Like, and not to mention all of the lives who've been touched by all of those people who were involved. It is outrageous. I mean, so many places now know, like, high-speed chases are unsafe, they are unacceptable, and the police should not be allowed to do them. A high-speed chase in the wrong direction on the highway? What the fuck is going on? What in the world is going on?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, more ridiculous policing news coming out of Canada. This is, it's unconscionable. And, of course, this stuff has to be controlled. We have to get a handle on this. We have to take more power away from the police. The police should not exist. This is just one of the proofs of how they do the opposite of what we are told they do.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. And, you know, there's been no real fallout from this. It hasn't been any, like, promises to change anything at all. It makes me think a lot of the Edmonton police chasing a man into the river to his death not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago now, where, you know, he was stopped for a bylaw infraction at 2:00 in the morning on a bicycle. Like, just give me a fucking break. Give me a break. The police in Canada, you know, had another blow dealt to them a couple of weeks ago, too, when it was found that 3 off-duty officers who approached a Muslim family in a parkade in Toronto just after Canada Day in 2001, the driver, the man in the family, accidentally ran over and killed one of the police officers because they didn't actually approach saying they were cops. They thought that they were coming to attack them. And luckily in that situation, the suspect, the guy who was accused of killing the officer, got off and was found not criminally responsible. And in that situation, you had Doug Ford, the premier of Ontario, and the fucking cops themselves getting involved in the trial, making comments about the trial, about the individual's guilt. And it's just like, you know, in the aftermath, like, here's someone whose life was also ruined by the police in the first place, acting like thugs, acting like they can just do whatever they want, or they can menace whoever they want, they can throw around their weight and throw around their you know, power and make people afraid. And it was like, oh, you made someone scared and he actually killed you. Like, oops. anyway, I don't see it getting better unless we organize. And I guess, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one other thing to say, just in terms of how the police have been talking about this case on the police and conservative politicians have been talking about this case on the highway, and how they spoke about Umar Zamir's case as well, is that we've been hearing more and more about this, like, oh, gosh, this type of stuff shouldn't happen. It's like, it's related to either catch and release, or that folks shouldn't be let out on bail when they are arrested for such heinous crimes. So with Umar Zamir, that was one of the things that that police and how conservative politicians were talking about. It was that this person should not have been let out on bail back when they were engaged in a very intense PR campaign a police officer was killed. So they're like, this guy is a cop killer, blah, 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 blah. And now we, of course, know more of the details of what's happened. And of course, it is so not how those people were talking about it, that the judge in the case apologized to Umar Zamir. With respect to this highway chase, I've seen, I don't know that this has been confirmed. In fact, a lot of people were talking about how it wasn't confirmed. Some conservative politicians saying that this is because this was someone who was caught and released, who is on bail. This is how they talk about it, catch and release. It's like, all of these weird discussions that are like encroaching on our freedoms, a very important one of which is that we are innocent. We are to be innocent and considered innocent until proven guilty. And bail is a very important part of that, being able to be free until you have your day in court to discuss whatever it is a very important part of that. And there are a lot of politicians right now in Canada who in their attempts to whip up support using some of the sort of culture war tactics that we've seen over the years have been increasingly talking about this catch and release bail stuff, and folks should pay a lot of really close attention to it and make sure that you're not being fooled by that, but also that you are poking holes in those conversations wherever you hear them in your lives.
Totally. Well, luckily, there's more going on than just the cops in this country, isn't there?
Thank goodness. Nora, last week we discussed feeling a little sad because we weren't seeing some of the same campus protests that we were seeing in the United States protesting the genocide in Gaza. And you know what? Last week I was feeling like, man, none of my alma maters are doing the thing. And this week, both UCLA and the University of Toronto, they're doing the thing. And it's
all of them are.
It's really great to see students taking the type, students and faculty and campus communities taking the type of action that was so critical to other similar fights in the past, like ending South African apartheid, and doing what they can, because they have always been at the forefront of these types of issues. And it's just really heartening to see that sort of organizing is alive and well in Canada.
Yes, yes, yes. It's really amazing. So there are campus encampments set up all over the place. Of course, McGill, which is organized not just by McGill students, but also Concordia students. And I believe there's other students from other campuses as well who've participated too. Then there's also, of course, the pretty big one, the big focal point in Toronto, which is at the University of Toronto. Again, I imagine there are other students from other institutions around that are also participating in the University of Toronto campus encampment. And then I've seen also at UBC other actions happening all over Canada. It's really, really wonderful. And, you know, like, one of the things that I think that might be confusing to people is why the tactic of an encampment? Like, what is the point of actually holding space and doing that? And a lot of times is like, especially with the American schools, there's been a lot of focus on divestments from Israel and calling for institutions to divest from Israel. But, you know, even in the case where a school might have no investments in Israel at all, I think it's still really important for people to take space on their campuses, students to take space on their campuses, because it's one of the few remaining truly public spaces that we still have in society. And students are one of the remaining groups in society that actually have the time, not all students, and of course you don't have a lot of time, but the time, the energy, and the access to certain resources to be able to actually do an encampment. And so I think it's just wonderful. I think it's the natural next step in the ongoing struggle all across Canada to force our politicians to actually do something constructive to end the genocide in Gaza. And it's just so wonderful. It's just awesome to see.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think that there's a couple of things that we can talk about here with respect to these encampments. And one of them is just some advice for the students and the faculty and alum, anyone who's a part of like a campus community. If you're alum and you haven't signed an open letter or tried to go to support in any way that you can, please do. I mean, these types of actions are really, really tough. And having alumni support is really critical, because these institutions, colleges and universities, they rely on alumni support as a big piece of their donor base, as a big piece of their revenue. And when they see that some sort of campus issue has impacted how alumni are responding, that is one of the ways that institutions will move to either make sure that they are not being embarrassed, or to make sure that alum are not upset. And so if you can provide that sort of support in any way as an alum, please, please do. Another piece of advice that I have for the folks who are on campuses, I've seen some of these protests have ended in the United States because an institution has like promised to hold a vote in October, or like has promised to have a series of conversations with students. And so the students are like, okay, we have won because we are able to have discussions, which are negotiations. Folks, this is a tactic that institutions have used forever, that schools are very, very familiar with. Yes, they will promise to have a series of conversations with you, a series of conversations where you remove your leverage, which is your ability to have this very public conversation, and your very public, impossible to avoid protest happening on campus. They say you remove all of that leverage that you have and we will have a conversation with you. And then conversations happen behind closed doors where the university does nothing. And then everything is over because all of the energy has been diffused. So if you are being promised that, my advice to you is to say, feel free to have a conversation with us out in the open. Have it come down to the campus protest and have it there. Have it in public, in newspapers or what have you. But do not end your protest over an institution promising to have a conversation. That's not what you're there for. You're not there for a conversation. You're there for so much more.
Yeah, but that actually raises a really important question, which is like, what is the protocol to figuring out when you have one, or when it's time to pack up, or when it's time to get bigger? Like, what kind of decision-making structures have you built into these kinds of actions and organizing? And so if you are in an encampment, of course you need to be making sure that you're having daily check-ins and meetings, and people are able to express like, man, this is really hard for these reasons. Okay, how do we fix that? How do we make sure that it doesn't, you know, that we can lessen how difficult it is for people so that we can continue the struggle in the way that we want to continue the struggle? Or what will we consider a victory? Because maybe victory at this point is literally just getting through the convocation season so that the administrations have to deal with this. Or maybe the victory is, I don't know, like you decide internally. Maybe it's an unequivocal condemnation of the genocide from your administrators. There's a lot of really creative things that you can do, but making sure you do have something in mind, I think, is really important, because it does always feel difficult to know when to pack it up. And not that that has to happen soon necessarily, but you definitely want to have an exit strategy, because you don't want to feel like you're just continuing it in just to be able to continue it, because that in and of itself is the victory. And Sandy, I'm wondering, like, how did you folks decide, like, what was your benchmark of success when you had an occupation outside of police headquarters in Toronto?
Well, honestly, for that protest, our benchmark of success kept shifting because we had to evaluate what was happening on the ground every day. We were not confident that we would be able to stay as long as we did. And we took a tactic that was, I think, in terms of safety, the best in making sure that we could stay for as long as possible, which was that we moved the protest initially started at Nathan Phillips Square, which, if you're familiar with Toronto, is kind of off from the street. It's hard to see. And the cops assembled probably like two mounted police officers, maybe even three mounted police officers for every protester that was there that night and, you know, declared that they were going to come attack us if we didn't leave. And so we made the decision to leave and camp out right in front of Toronto Police Headquarters because it was closer to the street and more people could see us and it was light, brighter outside. And for us, it was every single day, every single night, like could have been a night that we ended it. And so we were evaluating each night, like, what are we accomplishing today? How many people have come out? Are we changing the minds of people? Are we having a discussion in the media that's like a mass education discussion that's useful? Are we talking about Andrew Loku? Are we getting his story out, which was the impetus for us being out there? And then also, are we talking about carding, which was a big fight that was happening at that particular point? So we ended up staying for 2 weeks. And at the close, we did have like a couple of victories in that politicians that we were trying to get, people in power that we were trying to get to respond to us, agreed to have their, like, you know, they did the same tactics that we just talked about. They tried to get us to agree to have meetings behind closed doors. We refused to do that. And there were like huge town halls that happened in Toronto a few times that were just these big public meetings where the Black community was able to speak directly to power in ways that they hadn't been able to before. And I mean, for us, that and the idea that that people's minds had been changed, that we had shifted people, were the big victories. Now, a lot of people will look back at that time and recognize that that was when also the province announced its changed policy on carding on the same day that we ended the protest. But honestly, while that was like related, it wasn't the real reason. The real reason was that we felt like the goal that we had wanted to accomplish had been successful. And so, I mean, that's going to be different for each person, for each protest, I think, as well, because we were also at the same time evaluating what resources we had, what sort of support we needed, how we personally were doing. There's so much that goes into how you decide whether or not a protest is complete. And I think that there's a lot of history with these types of protests in particular. There's a lot of history with respect to apartheid and these protests. And for folks who are wondering, you know, when do we end this or how do we end that? You know, you take a look at that history. And also, if you are calling for divestment on your campus, I think that, you know, those tactics in the late 80s and 90s, they were successful. And so there are people who are around in your communities who were a part of those protests. And it's probably a good idea to get in contact with those people and find out how things ended for them.
Totally. And also, like, try to get in touch with protests in the States as well. See if there's ways that you can be in touch with the students at Columbia. You know, they have managed to cancel a commencement on May 12th, which was one of the things the university was using as the excuse for why they needed to be cleared out, because these commencements needed to start. It's awesome. It's awesome. And the strength and the capacity that builds, you can see it already in different parts of government apparatuses. So, you know, today that we're recording, so yesterday on Monday, Sarah Jamma was kicked out of the Ontario Legislative Assembly as they threatened her to be kicked out if she wore her kefia again, and she did. But this time, there was actually a little bit of support in the Legislative Assembly. Did you see this, Sandy?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, so Kristen Wong Tam and Joel Harden were also wearing kefias. Now, I assume they didn't get kicked out because they hadn't been warned yet, but they left with Sarah in solidarity as they were wearing kefiyas within the Legislative Assembly. So, you know, that, okay, two members of the NDP, I mean, guys, this party is pathetic, but that two, that's better than we've seen at all, since October 7th, frankly. And so that doesn't happen just because of the strength of one person or a couple of people. That happens because protests are continuously growing in strength and showing that people are not abandoning this. That rather than as time passes, support wanes, support is actually getting much more stronger and much more significant. And it's forcing people to actually make decisions finally, and they will make sometimes the right decision. So the encampments, like, keep them up. And if you're interested in starting another encampment, again, get in touch with the folks at U of T or at McGill. They might be able to give you some tips. I know there's a lot of really great protocols that are happening to make sure that the encampments stay safe and they stay sustainable, because that's always difficult when you're kind of creating these new kinds of spaces. And that physical manifestation of our collective opposition to the genocide in Gaza is just so important, because then all of the intentional forgetting and all of the intentional spinning of the message won't work as well when there is a physical reminder of what is happening. And this is especially important considering that this past weekend, you know, Israel banned Al Jazeera entirely from Israel and the West Bank. Like, things are,
oh my God,
I know, things are really, really, really bad, and our resolve has to remain really strong. Now, breaking news, literally as we're recording, is that Hamas has accepted the terms of a ceasefire to stop the bombardment of Rafah.
Wow. Wow. And will that be respected? If history tells us anything, the answer is likely no. But things are happening, are continuing to happen at, like, in a way that I really cannot fathom. Just like, fucking how difficult this must be. Where are people supposed to go? What are they supposed to do? But if that ceasefire has been accepted, let's see what that means, Nora, because I think we all know what Israel's true intentions are here. I mean, they've declared it. They want to develop the land for more settlements and so on. And so, you know, let's see. I just wanted to say also, like, back to the campus protests. You know, I spoke a little bit about what alumni could do. There is, if you are a University of Toronto alum, there is a open letter that over 3,000 alum have signed now. And the reason why I'm pointing to this one is not because, you know, well, I am a U of T alum, but that has nothing to do with it. It's just this letter refers to the University of Toronto's statement of institutional purpose. It's a really beautiful statement of institutional purpose, which talks about, I mean, when I was on campus and protesting, it was like something that we would throw in the university's face all the time, because it's such a beautiful statement. It's like, it refers to a vigilant protection for individual human rights, a resolute commitment to the principles of equal opportunity, equity, and justice, and about how crucial it is that people have the right to freedom of speech, academic freedom, and freedom of research. And that it is this human right to radical, critical teaching and research with which the university has a duty above all to be concerned. For there is no one else, no other institution, and no other office in our modern liberal democracy, which is the custodian of this most precious and vulnerable right of the liberated human spirit. And I raise this because this statement of institutional purpose was rewritten in 1992.
Ooh.
And yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure that it is related to the University of Toronto finally deciding to divest in full from South African apartheid, which took some time. They first agreed to divest all of their investments in 1988, with the exception of the any investments that were related to pensions, which they didn't do until I believe it was 1990 or 1991. But it's so interesting to me that after all of the protests that happened on campus, which included occupations of the president's office and so on, that this is when they rewrite the statement of institutional purpose. And of course, the institution was like, when they did finally divest, were, you know, in the beginning, they were really defensive, as they were this week when the University of Toronto and several other institutions sent out these letters to the people who were protesting, to their campus community, saying that this is trespassing and you will not be allowed to do this and you will be removed at this time and blah, 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 blah. When they finally ended up doing the divestment, you know, they were very proud of this. They were like, we are removing our holdings, blah, 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 blah. And this is how this typically tends to happen, right? I just think it's so interesting that after that period of time, the statement of institutional purpose was rewritten in a way that makes me think like that it was rewritten for specifically these types of purposes, to make sure that the university would remember that that the actions that its students, that faculty, that the campus community took during that time is important. It needs to be respected. It needs to be protected, and that the institution has a role to play in the protection of, as it terms it, human rights throughout the world internationally. And I just wanted to point to that as people maybe on campuses frightened, nervous about what the institution's next steps are, or whether or not you can make some sort of impact. You will, and you are. Guaranteed, you are making a huge impact, especially in those offices where there are the people in power are certainly like, we would prefer that this would not be happening at all. But there are people who are working in those offices who are like, can we maybe think about this? Can we discuss this? Can we talk about what to do here? And I mean, the proof is in the way that the institutions have been threatening to engage with the protesters, and in a lot of cases, not actually following through on that, because they know, they've seen what's happened in the United States, how awful it has been. They don't want to be that guy. They want to be the guy that's on the right side of history. And so keep showing them, you know, what the right side of history is.
Absolutely. And, you know, you talk a lot about the University of Toronto and the fight against South African apartheid really, really was a huge issue at the University of Toronto. I don't know. I kind of assume it was also a big deal at McGill, and maybe it's just because I was schooled in Toronto that I was oriented more towards U of T. But I imagine that a lot of the large universities in Canada were very, very, very concerned, and active student activists were active on that issue. And so you should look at, you know, the schools in your area and see what was going on, if you can find it in 1990, 1991, the late 1980s. This, of course, also was where a lot of the shittiest right-wing politicians cut their teeth, that end up becoming, like, going on and becoming members of, like, Stephen Harper's government. And so that also is happening currently today, building a next generation of shitty politicians in reaction to the good stuff that's going on. Now, one I think is really fascinating is now we have this situation where three members of provincial parliament in Ontario have been kicked out or left the legislature because of wearing a keffiyeh. And now Doug Ford is promising reporters that he will clear out the encampments. Chris Rishoi from the Toronto Star is reporting that Ford tells reporters people are fed up with the encampments at universities and they need to be cleared out. Quote, I can't stand some of the nasty stuff I've been seeing out there, unquote. So, again, making it up its way to the premier, forcing the premier to take basically a pro-genocide stance because he can't stand to look at these encampments, as if Doug Ford has seen a university campus in his life. And the strength that is growing at the encampment level, I mean, it's just going to grow out from there. So if you're in a place in Canada where there is no encampment, you know, maybe get inspired by this and figure out some local kind of space to have some sort of physical presence to say, you know, you condemn what is happening in Gaza. You don't have to set up an encampment. I know that's a huge commitment. So maybe that's not going to be the tactic that you choose wherever you are located. But this is the next step of civil disobedience. It's peaceful. It is beautiful. Things kind of are amazing that grow from these spaces. And you definitely can look out for calls for support, whether that is material support, because for sure there's going to be requests for material support, or if it's just to come down at moments when, you know, police might be breaking things up if that does happen in the near future. Okay. So as we're recording this episode and as the news is breaking that Hamas has accepted a ceasefire deal. So this was a ceasefire deal brokered by Egypt. And the news seems to be coming out that Israel will not accept the terms. They've rejected that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know... The struggle for justice is long and not easy, but every little piece that we can do that forces, even that forces the politics in Canada, if the Conservatives really, really want to be the party of Zionism, that will put the Liberals, and it has put the Liberals already into a really awkward position as they're trying to differentiate themselves from the Liberals, from the Conservatives. I can't even do it myself. And convince people to vote for them, as, you know, eventually is going to have to happen. They have to actually get reelected. And so, you know, forcing these kinds of issues on the ground in a way that indicates where a party is really, really important. And so regardless of whether or not Doug Ford is blowing hot air or if he is going to call in like the military to clear these encampments, I doubt that's going to happen, but who knows? Again, these are all steps towards us getting to a place where we actually can actually make change. And it's not just Canada. It's not just the United States. It's not just any single country. It's a swell of people, of average people, saying that we reject what is happening, and we reject what is happening in some cases in our name, on behalf of our government. You know, as Canadians, we reject Canada giving military arms to Israel, but even more importantly, receiving military arms from Israel. We reject that. We reject this global order that subjugates people, that privileges money over all else, and that people in power are fighting tooth and nail to protect. We reject that. And if our governments want to make it impossible for our opposition to something actually changes their opinions or changes their politics or changes their minds, well, guess what? Then it's just going to get worse and it's just going to get more intense. And there will be a breaking point. The question is, where is the breaking point? How much further do we have to push? The only way we can find out the answer to that is by pushing.